Good morning, everyone. Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ,
blessed Master,
saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Bliss that we sit here today. As you may know, Carla and I took a trip to Florida to see her mother and relatives. And it was an interesting trip. I think that oftentimes, if not always, when we take trips to physical locations, it represents a change in consciousness as well. Every part of this earth and every part of creation holds within it a certain vibratory realm. And then according to the people and the associates that we have during such journeys, we are taken into many different states of consciousness. And when the entire creation is made up of divine consciousness, then these are various types of harmonies and perhaps disharmonies and the various kinds of music that an orchestra may make. It only occurs on the vibrational realm. And shortly after arriving there, after many years of having my consciousness extended out into, you might say, an all consciousness or a universal consciousness, it was as if I was enshrouded in a cave. Now, the feeling and the presence of God was very much there in his absence, you might say. And this was my experience for many days there. And then at one point, we took a trip to New Orleans. And there we went to a wonderful cathedral. It's said to be the oldest continuously operated cathedral in the United States. It's at Jackson Square, and it's St. Louis Cathedral. And in 1987, I believe it was, Pope John Paul II had been there, and he had prayed with the different cardinals and different priests there. And so I had wanted to go inside that cathedral. We had walked by it the day before, but I had wanted to go inside. And we went inside, and as I say, up until that point, I had this feeling and this experience of being as if I was in a cave instead of having consciousness extended out into the all consciousness of God. And entering into that cathedral, I felt a powerful, uplifting vibration, a divine vibration. And I felt myself once again moving out from that insular cave into the all consciousness, and I felt a tremendous upliftment. And we spent some time there looking at the stained glass, the beautiful stained glasses. It's not perhaps the most beautiful cathedral. We had visited the one at Mobile, the earlier visit, and it's physically much more beautiful in that sense. But it's very interesting, and they have wonderful paintings up on the ceilings, stained glass. It's really a magnificent place. And so at one point I decided that if I didn't leave pretty soon, I might not leave for quite a long time. I was in such an uplifted state. So I walked out, and out on the street was walking along was the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal. So Carla came out, and she thought that the governor should meet me. So she put herself in his way, and he stopped, and we had a wonderful conversation. He's a wonderful man and very popular governor right now of Louisiana, and I think will be somebody who will enter onto the national scene and become more well-known. He's of East Indian origin. He was raised a Hindu, but in his high school years, he converted to Catholicism. So he's a very interesting man, and it's interesting that that experience should occur just after having been in that cathedral and being lifted up in that kind of experience. One of the things, as you know, is that the Hurricane Katrina had hit New Orleans, and this French Quarter that we were in was not devastated as some other parts of the city were. But still, there was some damage, and a tree had been knocked down, and there is a beautiful statue of Jesus out in front with his arms outstretched. And when the tree came down, it knocked off two of his fingers. And so the saying is among there and the locals that Jesus flicked the storm away because it was Category 5, and by the time it started to veer away from New Orleans, and it actually didn't get the brunt of it, it got downgraded to a Category 3. So because it veered course, it said that Jesus lost two of his fingers when he flicked the storm away. So, from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, these are wonderful, wonderful writings. We have a treasury of wisdom that has come down from Master. And of course, Master got much of it from Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar also wrote a commentary on the first 9 chapters of the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. You see, everything is in multiples of 3s and 9s. Those are considered sacred numbers in Hinduism. And Sri Yukteswar had written commentaries on the first 9 chapters. He never finished the ones on the last 9, but as he told Master, when they would meditate upon these various verses, they would take a verse, and for weeks and perhaps months at a time, they would stay on a singular verse, meditating deeply on them, and then Sri Yukteswar would ask questions about it and plumb the depths of his disciples' understanding of these. And Master would get impatient with this. He wanted to move on. He wanted to get through the entire book, you see, and get as much from Sri Yukteswar as he could. But Sri Yukteswar took this very slow pace with it. And you see how the human mind gets anxious. It wants to take in more information, but Sri Yukteswar wanted something different. Through the deepened meditation and focus on each one of these sayings, he wanted Master and all who were gathered with him to open their channel of intuition so that they would understand not merely from the mind. You see, it's so easy in reading books and taking in information of various kinds. It's so easy, isn't it, to get focused on what the mind is interested in. But the human mind is unlimited. Our intuitional mind, based on God realization, is unlimited. Sri Yukteswar, in focusing on these few verses and then testing the disciples, was seeing how their intuition was attuning itself to these verses and plumbing the depths of wisdom that was there. And at one point, without getting that far into the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Yukteswar saw that Master Yogananda was really opening his intuition unto these verses. And he says, now you are prepared on your own to be able to continue the reading of these verses and to get the real wisdom out of them. So he didn't even continue with these classes in that kind of a way. You see, this is not a kind of a linear way that the mind ordinarily thinks of taking on a study of something. But it goes to a deeper truth. And unless we are willing to really focus our attention in this kind of a way to open our own eyes of intuition, we can benefit from taking in these teachings. And we can benefit from the wisdom that's being given to us. But we don't get the full benefit if we don't go into the depths of really opening our own eyes of intuition. It's the thing that I've always loved about this path. And really, the thing that I demanded. I didn't want to find a teacher or teachings where perhaps I would be involved in memorizing certain texts or certain other people's interpretations. I wanted to know the truth myself. And there's a vast difference between reading books and thinking on things and deciding what you think is true and going into a subject with your eye of intuition and having it resonate through your entire being and knowing that this is the truth. Now, we can get fooled along the way, and of course, that's why we have teachers and that's why we have teachings, so that we don't get sidetracked. So we don't run onto a fool's errand, because the ego can run away with things. But when that should not dissuade us from really tapping into that deep source of truth ourselves. We should be exacting spiritual scientists. We should not just run away with anything that the mind thinks. You hear different commentators, and they're like will-o'-the-wisps. They're just whatever gust of wind is blowing that day. That's the way the mind goes. And isn't it glorious? And isn't it interesting? And isn't this awesome? And it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any spiritual power behind it because that individual has not paid the price. In order to really open their eye of intuition, it's a thing of the mind. And there may be glimpses of intuition, but it's not the full thing yet. It's not the full state of realization. And this is what we must be determined to gain for ourselves. Now, in this Gita, everything is not what it seems. There are different characters, there are different places, and even as I was saying, as traveling to different places represents different states of consciousness. This battlefield of Kurukshetra is the place where consciousness does battle with itself. The uplifting, transformational consciousness of spirit is meeting on the battlefield those forces of ego that are constricting and want to limit and want to hold in. So spirit is expansive, uplifting. Ego consciousness is contracting, restricting, limiting. And so these dual forces go on within ourselves. And at the third chakra represents Arjuna. Now, Arjuna represents individualistic will. And Arjuna has asked Krishna, which represents the sixth chakra. That's the divine consciousness within you. And it is the Christ. And he has asked the Christ to be his charioteer. Now, normally, a charioteer is somebody of a lower level than the warrior is, the one who is riding in the back of the chariot. But in this case, Krishna voluntarily takes that role because as the third chakra, which is individual will, looks to God for his will, surrenders itself to his will, to God's will, this is the act that Arjuna is doing. And as a result, Krishna is there to help instruct and guide Arjuna at every turn. And to guide him through this battle. Now, not everything goes the way of Krishna and Arjuna. There are days when they lose battles. There are days when things go against them, seemingly. And yet Krishna is there at every step of the way to help Arjuna to fight the battle. Now, what does this mean to us individually? It means that as we climb the spinal stairway of consciousness, we come up against oppositional forces. Now, these are not foreign or strange things. We might think of the devil as being this personality who comes, who is frightening and terrifying and unknown. But many of these forces, these oppositional forces, are extremely well known to us. They're so familiar, we might even say, I am that. I am that state of consciousness. I am that thought. I am that feeling. And that's how subtle and how pernicious, you might say, these things are to us. They're not far away from us. They're those habits. They're those things that we do that distract us and take us further away from divine consciousness. Now, those of us who are very sincere and who are really striving to attain divine consciousness, we know very well what those oppositional forces are. So in this story, they are represented by different characters, various actors. And some of them have been those instructors, those teachers of Arjuna in his growing up. And what this symbolizes for us is that even those things that have served us well, that have been a positive influence in our life, those habits, those thoughts, those things that have really helped to lift us up in a way to the point where we're at some point we have to overcome them because they're strictly mental conceptions. They're not the truth. They're not intuition yet. They're a thing of the mind. And so even though the world might say this is a good thing, at some point that becomes an obstacle to you. So this is where we pick up the story. And Arjuna is faced with these various teachers across the field, and he's looking at them. And he's thinking to himself, and he's saying to Krishna, can I take these on? I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want to destroy these ones who have served me so well. So Arjuna said, O slayer of Madhu, destroyer of foes, Krishna, how can I, in this war, direct arrows against Bhishma and Drona, beings who should be worshipped? And Master's commentary, the rationalizing thoughts of self-control responded to the inner voice of intuition. O slayer of the demon of ignorance and of the inner temptations, how can I, in this psychological war, lose the arrows of my determination against my psychological grandparent, Bhishma, or the ego, and my preceptor, Drona, past habits? These are venerable mentor tendencies, originators of my present mental states. How frightful to destroy them by spiritual renunciation and by the arrows of yoga meditation. As previously cited, the various characters mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita symbolize the different psychological states in which a devotee is identified. When the devotee is identified with the restless mind, he is spoken of as being in the desireful Duryodhana state, very difficult to control, the state in which the devotee is concentrated on human instincts and prenatal tendencies, or samskaras, born of past life habits, is said to be in the Drona state. When the devotee forgets his true soul nature and is identified with the circumscriptions of mortal body, then he is in the ego or Bhishma state. During meditation, when the life force and the mind are withdrawn internally, this partially interiorized state of self-realization is spoken of as the Arjuna state or state of self-control. As the yogi withdraws his mind within and his sixth sense, intuition, begins to develop, he finds himself pulled towards the vastness of his soul. He gradually loses sight of all mental and physical boundaries. At this time, the devotee feels a certain fear, like a person on his first airplane flight, when he has left behind customary landmarks and is soaring into the wall-less ether. You may have had this experience yourself. I know I did many, many times. I would start to get into an uplifted state, and then almost with a start, I would draw back into my mortal frame again. Because there was a feeling of being out of control. You're being lifted up, but you don't know where. You're being taken on a journey, but you don't know what the end of that journey will be. And so with a start, you draw yourself back in. It's an instinct that has to be controlled and has to be fought, but this is a very real thing that happens to you. When he has only half climbed the spinal centers of inner perception, the Arjuna state of self-control, being in the third or lumbar center, he is afraid to look at the ruthless infinity toward which he appears to be headed. He loses sight of his physical ego consciousness. This does not signify the loss of consciousness, but only the forgetting of the confinements of the human ego. Discovering the illimitability, the devotee begins to be fearful of losing all human traits. This state signifies the killing of Bhishma, the venerable psychological relative, the ego, or the grandfather of all mental tendencies. And you see, these are very subtle things when we enter into them. There's reasons why we avoid going into deeper meditation. There's reasons why we get to a certain state and we begin to avoid our spiritual practice at all. And it may be something that's not completely conscious at the time. We just simply start staying away. We stop meditating, or we don't meditate for very long, or we don't go into very great depth of meditation. We get interested in all kinds of things in the world. Everything seems to attract our attention except what we're supposed to be doing spiritually. It's like the student at the university who has a test, and suddenly they're cleaning their room. You know, they're going out to coffee. They can find anything and everything to do but to sit down and study for their test. And a similar kind of way, we feel that kind of resistance, that repulsion, towards going into these more interiorized states. And so, if we are not guarding our spiritual practice very carefully, we can plateau. We can stop right there. However, in spiritual practice, there's no just treading water. You're either going up or you're going down. And so if you release your practice, if you stop your practice, if you quit going deeper, then you start getting drawn back down once again. And so this is something that happens to most all of us during our spiritual practice. In this inner meditative state, the devotee also finds himself rising above all habitual instincts and tendencies, no longer seeking mundane happiness. This signifies the killing of Drona. In this stanza, the meditating devotee is described as being filled with the memory of the vanishing ego and those habits and instincts that have become so natural to him. He is reluctant to use the darts of his inwardly retiring life force through pranayama and his controlled mind through pratyahara to destroy his association with his ego and his so-called pleasurable sense habits and inner tendencies in order to gain the native but deeply profound pleasures of soul expansion. And so it's not only a giving up of possibility of pleasures, but it's how we identify and define ourselves. If you think about the various things in your life, your occupation, the home where you live, relationships that you have, these are like the person who looks at the street where they live, and there's a church down on the corner. There's a large oak tree in a yard. There's all these various identifiers that let you know exactly where you're at in your neighborhood. I remember when God began to take away various things from me. He took away the relationships that I had at the time. He took away the occupation that I had. He took away so many different things, and I was surprised at the time at how much this affected me in the sense that I identified myself with these things. I knew who I was in this world by where I lived, by the occupation that I had, by the relationships that I had. And when these things were taken away, then I felt a bit at a loss. I felt like I was out in sea, but I didn't have any identifying markers in order to know where I was in the sea. I was just out there drifting. And God does this to you in various ways. Not everybody will go through all the experiences that I did. But He has a way of taking away these landmarks, these things that help you to identify, to know where you're at. Because in the end, these are limitations. And they're worshiping false gods. When you're set out at sea and there's absolutely no landmarks for you to identify yourself with, you have to go inside of you. You have to find that landmark, ultimately, of your soul connection with God, because that's the only thing that is eternal and forever. Everything else passes away. Everything else is but a transitory thing. And when we have transferred the focus of our attention from this inner connection with God and to all these outer connections to identify and say, this is who I am, then we have put false gods up on the altar and we're worshiping them. We're worshiping idols instead of the real thing. And the thing that is God that will serve us throughout this entire life and beyond. And it is the only thing that is eternal and lasting. So that is why all of these other things must pass away. And yet, as we know, the ego mind is very resistant to having this happen. To take the mind from the senses by meditation means the devotee must involve his self-control in a psychological war in which the retiring life force and concentration act as arrows to destroy the venerable, ignorantly worshipped physical ego and the inner habitual tendencies that keep man in a state of delusion. And this is such a beautiful description of where we're at as devotees, as aspirants. Because this is exactly where we find ourselves in terms of our own determination and our own use of human will. Everything in this life represents a temptation away from the one divine course, in the sense that if we remain satisfied with our identification with anything less than the omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent consciousness, the cosmic consciousness that God is, then we come up short of what our true and our real goal is. We're so afraid, you see, that if we give something up, we'll lose it. Life will become less interesting. Life will become less dynamic. Perhaps we'll even just die and fade away completely. Or we'll lose control. And somehow, everything that we think will bring us happiness will be taken away from us. And yet, we have living examples of great saints and realized masters that we have personally known. And we see that they enjoy life, that they are active participants in life. They're not non-beings. And yet they have gone through this transformative state of consciousness. They have let go of everything that has held them captive to limitation. Larry's talked about the Stockholm syndrome, which is a psychological state where they took students and they put them into kind of a prison or war camp kind of environment. And this happened in Sweden, and that's why the name Stockholm is there. And these university students, after being in this highly regimented, oppressive kind of environment, after a fairly short amount of time, began to identify with their captors. They made excuses of why the guards would be harsh and punishing with a certain person who was trying to escape or trying to defy their authority. And rather than collectively becoming a rebel and breaking out of the prison, they started to conform to everything and identify with the guards and make excuses for their behavior. And so this kind of Stockholm psychology can be applied to being here on this earth. We come into this earth with a memory of being in a freer kind of environment, the astral or the causal realms. And we know ourselves to be living in this freedom, and yet we have to encounter being in this body. And there are harsh reminders. There's hunger, there is pain, and then later on, there are shame and humiliation. And there are coercive forces that drive it home to us again and again and again that this reality has to be contended with. And so, for many of us, instead of rebelling against this and striving to get our freedom, not from society itself, but an inward spiritual freedom, we accept the confines to which we have been born into. And we accept as facts that these are our limitations. This is who I am. This is how life is. And it can't be any different. And I would be vain, and I would be imaginary, and I would be foolish to think that I could be anything more. And so we keep with what we have, and we accept it, and we accept the ground rules that are here. But the spiritual masters tell us these ground rules are a falsehood. This is ignorance, and this is vanity to give in to this. That the real heroes in life are those spiritual heroes that are willing to challenge these limitations that are self-enforced. First, they come from outside of us, but then after a while, we become the oppressors themselves. We become self-oppressive. And we even, if somebody that we know dares to dream a greater freedom, we begin to oppress them as well. It's interesting to me that with so many spiritual and religious organizations, there's a great founder, somebody who has found their spiritual truth, their freedom. And it's accepted now that that individual was a spiritual master. But if anybody within the ranks seeks to rise up and claim the same state of consciousness, they would be seen as heretics, even though the master taught for each one to gain their own spiritual freedom. The master is way up here and you're way down there, and don't you forget it. And if you do, you'll be put in your place. You see, it's just a natural reaction of the ego. It wants to contract. It wants to confine. Now, on the other hand, as I was saying earlier, we need to be careful spiritual scientists. We can't be just going with every passing fancy thought and saying, well, I have gained my spiritual freedom, when it isn't so, when we're still within the prison cell. So we have to be careful that way, but we should not preclude our own gaining of our own spiritual freedom. This is what the Master has come to teach us. This is what Mother came to teach us. This is what Master came to teach us. Sri Yukteswar, Lahari Masha, Babaji, Papa, Mataji, Swamiji. All of them are echoing the same truth. Proclaim your freedom. Gain your freedom. Do what is necessary to rise above these self-limiting thoughts and feelings and rise into your freedom. Claim your freedom and never let yourself looking back. Never let yourself look back. If you look back, you'll turn into a pillar of salt. This body is made of salt. You become concretized now. You become limited. And this is not what we should be. We should be free beings. And you should feel the bliss. You should feel the joy. You should feel the light. You should know the truth within yourself, not through thinking with this material mind, but through your intuitive perceptions. And so if you will do this, if you will claim your freedom, you will have it. You will have it. Now you must keep your mind upon God, glued upon God. That must be a steady and constant practice to chant God's name, to interiorize the mind, to let the things of this world recede into the background. All the noise, all the visual disturbances, everything just to recede into the background. Learn first to interiorize the mind. This is an absolute must. This is the pratyahara. And when you learn to interiorize the mind and awaken the spine through the kriya technique, and the spine becomes awakened, alive, the spine and the brain. And now the mind is interiorized, the spine and the brain are awake, and now open up those interior states of consciousness that lets you go beyond the little human ego, the little human frame, the little human concerns that you have day to day. And the peace, the freedom, the joy, the bliss that you will experience are so transcendent and so superior to anything else that you'll have, you'll wonder why you ever dilly-dallied along the way. Why didn't you run to the goal from the very beginning? Why were you ever afraid, is what you will think to yourself. Because far from becoming a nothing, you become everything. And far from losing any pleasure in life, you gain the bliss of God, the joy of God. And then when you come back, if it is yours to come back into human consciousness, then you can enjoy the physical kingdom, but in its own way, not that it dominates you, but rather you are master of it. And always and forever now, you live in that divine kingdom of spirit. So claim your freedom. Claim it now and always. And become one with that divine consciousness. If you'll pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet. And surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Bliss. Amen.